Western alienation is one thing, separation another. Preston Manning says separation does not enhance Alberta's clout. In fact, it diminishes it. As a standalone landlocked entity, Alberta will have less bargaining power than it has now, according to Manning. He says it's time to think big. He says by revisiting Alberta's history, you get a sense of the power of the West. The province was carved out of the massive region known as the Northwest Territories, and it was done so to limit its influence politically and economically back in 1905. So Manning says, with that in mind, separatists have to ask, what is the magnitude of our objective? Do we want to be a small little country that would be under tremendous pressure to join the United States within 20 or 30 years? Or do we want to reinvigorate the role and magnitude of the Great Northwest by working together as a bloc? Manning maintains that the future belongs to the West. He says we're on the right end of the country as Asian Pacific influence continues to grow, and by working as a bloc, the West can acquire clout and control over its resources. And then with a smile on his face, he says, that's my optimism showing. We invited Preston Manning to join us for a conversation that matters about Alberta, the current state of discontent, and a potential path forward. Preston Manning, welcome to Conversations That Matter. Thank you ever so much for joining me. Let's start with an idea of like where are we at with the sentiment around alienation in Alberta today, and then let's talk about how we got there and what the path forward might be.
Well, I think a lot of the alienation and frustration is understandable. You had this crash in oil prices. You had this hostility towards the energy sector and very little understanding of the hydrocarbon sector in the rest of the country. You've got a hostile federal government in the form of the Trudeau government, and now you've had this COVID crisis, which kind of overrides everything and makes it even more difficult for the government to do anything. So it is a perfect storm. And I think that for the starting point is that Albertans and Westerners generally need to decide what is their perspective going to be on the future. Some people say you should separate and have a small province. I'm not convinced. I don't see how that advances your ability to get pipelines or anything else, but the other approach is how can you get changes in the federation to make the West more at home. But the prerequisite to action on that front is Westerners pulling together rather than allowing themselves to be divided.
Westerners by Albertans, are you talking about, or are we talking Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta as a block because they all were born of the same territory? Or do you also include British Columbia in that discussion?
Well, I think of the West as everything west of the Manitoba-Ontario border. And I distinguish between the separatist sentiment today and the separatist sentiment that existed in the mid-1980s. When reform started, and there was a contest then between separation or does the West want in or does the West want out? At that time, this Western alienation was broader than it was today. It stretched all the way from Manitoba to Vancouver Island. Today, this alienation and secessionist sentiment is mainly concentrated in Alberta and Saskatchewan, and mainly southern Alberta rather than northern Alberta. So it's narrower, but it's more intense. Maybe it's more intense because it is narrower. But there's quite a difference between then and now. And again, it comes down to when you talk about the West, are you just talking about a fairly narrow chunk, Alberta and part of Saskatchewan, or are you talking about the whole Northwest? I think when Westerners talk about the smaller region, we reduce our significance and we reduce our clout, particularly in the eyes of the rest of the country.
I find it interesting that many Albertans don't even understand the history of Alberta, how it came to be as a province. And from your perspective, why is it important that we understand that history and the unique relationship that exists between Edmonton and Ottawa?
There's this old saying that if you don't know where you come from, you probably don't have a good idea where you are or where you're headed. So I attach a lot of importance to our our history, that at one time you had the Great Northwest was one huge territory that spread all the way from the Manitoba-Ontario border. It actually went further east because the territory went farther east in the north. And then the premier of the old Northwest Territories, F.W.G. Haultaine, who many people, or there's people that study it, think he was in the same league as MacDonald and Laurier. And he wanted the West to remain as one huge big province to counterbalance the weight of Ontario and Quebec in the Federation. And Laurier did not want that. Liberals were a Quebec-based party. Even back then, the traditional parties were based in the Laurentian region, and they didn't want that. So Laurier carved it up into three provinces and two territories. And so Alberta was created by the Alberta Act, which was passed by the federal parliament in 1905 and became one of those three provinces. But that was this, the big Westerners versus the little Westerners. And at that time, there were people in the West that supported the carving up. The Premier Rodman Roblin of Manitoba, he was the Premier of Manitoba when it was a little postage stamp province. And he wanted to be Premier of a province. And if there'd been one big province, he wouldn't have been. So there were Westerners that supported that little Westerner position, just as there are today Westerners that will support the separation, even if it's a small entity, rather than the big picture.
So when we take a look at the history of, let's say, British Columbia joining Confederation, British Columbia was a standalone colony within the British Empire, and it agreed to become a part of Confederation. Whereas the Northwest Territories had been all this property that was under the control of the British government, and it's my understanding that in the 1890s they said to Canada, here, you can have it. In essence, they gifted it to Canada, and it became the property of Ottawa. So does that mean that all of that territory and then the subsequent provinces that got broken up actually are still, for lack of a better word, chattel of the Ottawa government?
Well, no, it started out that way, but then, you know, there's been this persistent desire on the part of the West, and by the West I'm now talking about the prairie provinces, to get control of their own lands and resources. And ultimately they managed to do that by the Natural Resources Transfer Agreement in 1930. They got a constitutional amendment that transferred the ownership of lands and resources to the Western provinces. Before then, those lands were controlled by the federal government. In Alberta, there was over 6 million acres of Alberta land that was given by the federal government to railway companies that weren't even in Alberta. The federal government controlled it. Nothing Alberta could do to stop it. And it wasn't the Liberals or Conservatives that wanted to do that. It was only when there was a minority government in Ottawa and the old Progressives held the balance of power. The Progressives were a Western-based agricultural party. And their condition of supporting the Liberals was, you better agree to this Natural Resources Transfer Agreement. And Premier Brownlee was the premier in Alberta at that time. And Brownlee's career ended in a scandal. But if the only thing the guy ever did was get that Natural Resources Transfer Agreement, it was the most fundamental advancement of Western interests that you could have had. It's the reason why the royalties on oil and gas development flow to Edmonton instead of to Ottawa, or to Regina instead of to Ottawa.
So Premier Lougheed, though, also renegotiated the deal with Ottawa and strengthened that, but he was unable to wrestle control of the environment away from Ottawa. And this appears to be, in some ways, the Achilles heel of Alberta at the moment, that the federal government can come along and just say, no, according to our environmental plan, this is what you have to do.
Well, this is a good point. And this gets into, well, what can you do to advance not just Alberta's interests, but to advance the Western interests? And the single constitutional amendment that I think would advance that is a constitutional amendment prohibiting the federal government from legislating or policy making or treaty making in areas of provincial jurisdiction, which would include health and would include the environment, unless it gets the consent of the province that's affected. And it seems to me that constitutional amendment, or maybe you get it through a joint federal-provincial agreement, which would be easier to get than a constitutional amendment, ought to be something that virtually every other province in the country should support. You talk to Quebecers, they don't want the federal government to have unilateral power to intervene in any area of provincial jurisdiction. And so we may disagree on a whole bunch of things with Quebec, but surely on that subject, that's one place where the West and Quebec could agree.
Right.
And if that prohibition, and that wouldn't mean that the federal government couldn't intervene in the area of health or environment if the province consented to it. But
right.
if they didn't consent to it, then it couldn't. And I think that would reduce 50% or more of the tensions between Ottawa and the provinces, because most of those tensions arise out of the federal government using its spending power to interject itself into every other area, whether the Constitution assigns it to it or not.
So in 2001, you were one of a handful of people that included Stephen Harper at the time who wrote the firewall letter.
No, Stu, on that, no, I was not part of that.
Oh, you weren't? I thought you were. I thought, okay.
Yeah, no.
Tom Flanagan, I know, was there. I thought you were.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I knew all the fellows that did it.
Right.
I was still in the doing something else at that time. But I, you know, I know the sentiment, and this is still kind of the issue today. Do you try to make, even within the Confederation, you try to make Alberta more independent? And I was on this fair panel, this fair deal panel that Premier Kenney set up, and we heard a lot of that.
Right.
And the panel actually made some recommendations. Maybe you should consider setting up the Alberta pension plan and pulling out of the Canada pension plan. It's not as simple or easy as it sounds, but it could be done, and you'd be more separate on that front. You could set up an Alberta police force instead of having the contract with the RCMP. There's a number of things that could be done. While Alberta would still be in the Federation, it would be a lot more separate on some of those functions. And that's what, and the firewall letter got into some of those kinds of measures.
And so there were many elements out of that firewall letter that appeared, again, you know, fast forward 20 years, and there they are as part of the Fair Deal panel's mandate to examine.
Yeah,
when
yeah.
you came out of that Fair Deal panel process, what did you feel was the likelihood that we would be able to improve relations between Ottawa and Edmonton?
Well, I was optimistic that something could be done, but then, as I say, the Alberta got into this, it was almost into it then, it got into this perfect storm where the revenues of the Alberta government were enormously hit by the fall in energy prices, by the obstruction to the pipeline proposals, and then this COVID thing came along, which just, not just Alberta, but virtually every premier across the country's attention had been focused entirely on that, and these other measures get, I still think the government of Alberta is interested in them and probably committed to them, but it's simply not in a position to act on that front.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm, you know, there's this, what's a Canadian optimist is somebody who thinks that things could be worse. I actually think that things could be better. I'm that kind of optimist. I still think there are things that can be done, even in the midst of this COVID crisis. In fact, I think they're part of the answer to this COVID crisis. One of the things that the opposition in Ottawa and provincial premiers can argue is that there ought to be an economic impact assessment of every major health protection measure or environmental protection measure. If what you want is balance between health and environment and the performance of the economy. And so you could rightly ask, where's the economic impact assessment of Ottawa signing the Paris Accord? It doesn't mean you're actually automatically against it, but we want to know what's the economic impacts of that versus what maybe it can achieve environmentally, so that the government of the day can balance the two. Where was the economic impact assessment of the carbon tax regime? Again, whether you're for it or against it, at least you should know what's it going to do to the economy so you can balance the environmental benefits versus the economic benefits. And I would say the same thing's true on these COVID health protection measures. That's fine. Everybody understands you got to do something to protect health. But what's the economic impact of that? And so one of the things we can do, even in the midst of this crisis, that would address a number of these other issues, is do impact assessments of these major measures so that there can be balance between health protection and economic development, between environmental protection and economic development. And that's something that can be done now. It doesn't have to wait for some constitutional change or change in the government, if the government could be persuaded to do it.
Do you think that COVID-19 has exacerbated feelings of alienation, particularly in Alberta? Because, and the reason that I ask this, I happen to be in Alberta when former Green Party leader Elizabeth May and the Bloc Quebecois leader both said, well, don't give money to support Alberta until they get off of oil, because oil is dead. Like, it was as though there was a collective gasp throughout the province.
Oh, yeah, well, it certainly hasn't helped anything, and even on the broader scale. I mean, people are worried, they're frustrated, and if they were already worried or frustrated about Alberta-Ottawa relations, this atmosphere doesn't help that. And a lot of Albertans are furious about the hypocrisy on this environmental front. So suppose that you agree with this analysis, that every economic activity has environmental effects. The economy takes stuff out of the environment and puts waste back. Nobody disagree with that. Mm-hmm. I think most of us would agree that some of those impacts are negative. We should therefore figure out, what do you have to do to avoid or mitigate those impacts, and incorporate the cost of avoidance or mitigation in the price of the product that's being produced, so that the people that want that pay for the environmental protection aspects of it. Nobody disagrees with that. And so you can even apply that to the hydrocarbon industry, and you can even agree with a carbon pricing regime. I would say, if you have a carbon pricing regime, it ought to be revenue neutral. You ought to reduce the other taxes by the amount you're connecting to that level, so it doesn't constitute a tax or a tax increase. But here's the rub for Albertans. If that logic is correct, then don't you have to apply it to every other form of energy? If you internalize the environmental impacts of one energy source and don't do it with the others, don't you misprice the energy from those other sources and distort the market? And so you could ask, where's the reservoir tax for the hydro guys? Sure, they don't produce a lot of CO2, but they flooded, in Canada, they flooded carbon sinks the size of Lake Ontario. So where's the reservoir tax for them? I'd like to see the federal government to tell Quebec Hydro, here's what we're going to do on that front. Where's right. The radiation tax for the nuclear guys? The nuclear unions profess to be clean as the driven snow. They produce one of the deadliest poisons known to man. That is enormously costly to try to figure out what to do with it. Much of that's been paid for by public dollars. So where's the radiation tax for those guys? Where's the environmental levy for the wind guys and the solar guys? These are not environmentally neutral either. At the end of the day, they may be more environmentally, better environmentally than hydrocarbons, but the difference won't be between 0 and 1,000. It'll be between 500 and 600.
Do you think that we can lower the temperature a little bit in this tension right now? And if so, what would be the most important first couple of steps?
I'll come at it as a Canadian angle. Why did the Canadian cross the road? You know, the old joke is to get to the middle. So I think what's advocating, what's a balanced position on some of these issues? Like, and that's where I come to this issue between the environment and the economy. What's the balanced position? It requires you to know what all the environmental impacts are, but doesn't it require you to know what the economic impacts of your environmental measures are, so that the government can strike a balance? And I think there is an instinctive desire and appreciation on the part of Canadians for a balanced position, if someone can put it forward. Now, unfortunately, under these circumstances, we seem to polarize. And I think if someone really made it their mission in life to establish the balance on some of these issues, a balance in federal-provincial relations, a balance on environmental economy, balanced budgets, that there'd be a receptivity from the public. But you don't see much of that today. You see more polarization in the political arena than we've seen for a long time.
I know. It has become incredibly heated, and as a Canadian who does not live in Alberta, I don't want Alberta to go. I want us to have that productive, cooperative relationship that makes up Canada, which I think is a uniquely special country, but we also have our own unique and special challenges. So I'm hoping that
there are some encouraging things from our history too, because I had this experience with reform, and one of the arguments you get into in Alberta, and these are from well-meaning people, say, well, the reform effort, we supported all that, but what did it get us? What's the lesson from that? That's that you can form new political parties and you can get some clout, but you can't change it. I say to those people, I think you're missing the whole point of the main lesson that comes out of reform, which was a small group of people, five people met in a boardroom in Calgary in 1987 and said, we don't like any of these options, and by golly, we're going to provide another one. And you know, we ended up creating this party. It got a bunch of seats. It got 52 seats the first time, 60 some seats the second time. We then had to broaden it out and created that Canadian Alliance. This is a coalition of Westerners. It was reform with the Klein Conservatives, the Filmon Conservatives in Manitoba, the Harris Conservatives in Ontario, and created that Canadian Alliance. And then Harper and McKay put that together with what was left of the old Conservative Party, and they got a minority government and they got a majority government. You know, a small group of people, and I've been critical of the democracy in Canada. I think there's a lot of things wrong with it, but notwithstanding that, small group of people were able to take the tools that democracy gives to everybody and use it to have some influence, at least. It got a national government for 9 years with a strong Western base. And what I say to a lot of the discontented people today is that can be done again. It can be done again. It's not a hopeless situation where you can't affect anything and you can't change anything. I think you can. But again, it comes back to almost the first question you raised is to what's the magnitude of your objective? Do you want to create a small little country that would be under enormous pressure to join the United States within 20 or 30 years, or do you want to reinvigorate the role of the Great Northwest in the country as a whole? And I think time is on our side. I think everything is shifting towards the Asia-Pacific region, which stands the West in good state. We're at the right end. We're on the right side of the country for that.
Right.
Well, that's my optimism.
Yep. Well, I hope you're right. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to share your insights with us. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you, Stu. I enjoyed it. Yeah.